This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. The investigation into the Gilgo Beach murders on Long Island, New York, spreads to three other states, New Jersey, South Carolina, and Nevada. CBS's Lilia Luciano.
CBS News has learned police are looking into whether one or more of the three murders Rex Huerman is charged with may have taken place inside the Long Island home he shared with his wife and children. His family was apparently away at the time of those murders.
There's absolutely no evidence that anyone acted with the defendant, much less his family.
Law enforcement officials also tell CBS News investigators are looking to see if Huerman is connected to other unsolved murders throughout the county and the country.
Heat alerts stretch across the southern half of the country. CBS's Carter Evans in Palm Springs, California.
Air conditioning really cranking across the country right now. This heat dome is so large, and there are some estimates that electric bills are going to go up about 12% this summer. So on average, people are going to be expecting to spend about $580 this summer.
Moscow says airstrikes on the port city of Odessa, Ukraine, were in retaliation for an attack that closed a bridge to Crimea. The U.S. believes it was an attempt to block Ukrainian grain exports. CBS's Charlie Daggett in Kyiv.
The timing you've got to look at, which is where the State Department is saying, well, wait a minute, these are exactly the kind of ports that Ukraine's grain would be sailing from. And it comes at precisely the same time that an international agreement has expired that Russia has not extended that would have allowed safe passage. Cargo ships to sail from those ports.
CBS's Wendy Gillette with a look at our drinking habits during the pandemic.
Alcohol-related deaths surged during the pandemic, going up more than 150% between 2018 and 2021 in Mississippi, the state with the largest increase, and almost 75% in Delaware. Dr. George Koob directs the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism.
We attribute this to individuals using alcohol to cope with stress.
Koob says underage drinking has decreased, but those over 21 are drinking more.
What we've been seeing over the last 20 to 30 years is that women are catching up with men in drinking.
Wendy Gillette, CBS News.
In the nation's capital, police are investigating a deadly crash in a parking garage at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital. One woman was killed and five other people were injured. D.C. Fire and EMS spokesman Vito Maggiolo.
I don't have an age on the driver. We evaluated the patient. They appear to be uninjured physically. Obviously, they were in distress.
One official says there's no indication the crash was intentional. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For 105.7 CFW and the Tap 93.5 FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. This year's drought got worse for some and better for others in the past week, despite some heavy rains that have come through the area. In west central Wisconsin, including St. Croix, Dunn, and Chippewa counties, the drought monitor dropped from moderate down to abnormally dry. However, extreme drought has now set in the far northern part of the state, and severe drought is in place over parts of Barron, Rusk, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. 82% of the state is considered to be in drought. That's down from 90% a week ago. It's been a day since powerful storms went through northwestern Wisconsin, dropping large tennis ball-sized hail in some areas. The storms also brought high winds 55 to 65 miles per hour, and some funnel clouds were even spotted. Damage to trees, power lines, and outbuildings has been reported. However, the National Weather Service says no reports of anybody hurt by last night's storms. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
The Tap.
Take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Morgan Stanley, and I'm going back to this, Morgan Stanley tweeted out today that they're making a sizable upward revision to the GDP this year, with the largest contribution coming from stronger than expected, you guessed it, public investment. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, they say, is driving a boom. Economy's getting better. Jobs are being created. Manufacturing buildings being built, lots of money heading in the right direction here to share some thoughts on the Morgan Stanley comment, because I think this is kind of a big deal, something that we should be talking about. That's why I've asked Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Great to be in your show.
So what do you make of Morgan Stanley's thing here, saying, hey, we're making a sizable upward revision to GDP, and it's that government investment, that public investment in roads and bridges and stuff.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's kind of the way people said it would work months ago when the president signed the bill. And it's because all the people who are building these bridges and roads are getting paid. These billions of dollars that they allocated, it's not like the naysayers say that they're just being thrown away. They're not burning the money. They're giving the money to people who are doing the work. And all those people are buying stuff for their kids and going on vacation and going out to dinner and going on dates with their boyfriends and girlfriends and spending money. And that's what's helping the economy go. Most of our income nationwide, 70% over that, is consumers spending money on stuff. And if consumers have more money in their pockets, they spend it.
Now, the thing that gets me is, Republicans have been saying for a very long time, hey, recession's coming, and almost hoping and dreaming for recession. So to see someone like Morgan Stanley saying, hey, things are going well, there's a boom happening, I gotta tell you, I'm sure there's some people who are kind of depressed about that.
There could be. I mean, I don't read people's minds. I mean, there are people who don't like the idea of everyone doing well. Don't forget, when they talk about make America great again, whatever that means, if they mean the 1950s, with Ozzie and Harriet, they also mean the area where, like, there was an underclass of black people who couldn't vote and couldn't ride the train and couldn't eat in the restaurants. They also mean a time, when not everyone could vote. And a lot of things have improved since then for a lot of people. And frankly, there are people who don't like it because they're kind of barely above the bottom, and they think the people below them are catching up, and they think they're going to be tied for last. And maybe they're right, but I don't know what to say to them.
Yeah, see, but here's the thing. If you feel like you're going to be tied for last, isn't, you know, I guess as a sports guy, isn't the goal to not just be one above last, but to move up forward? You know, maybe push for things that are going to help you. I don't know. Move upward instead of, you know, trying to stay from going down?
Or maybe don't focus on how many people are below you, but focus on yourself and what you can do and whether you have enough money to pay for stuff for your family. And be happy if you're doing well, even if your neighbors are also doing well. I think people should learn to take pleasure from how well they're doing, yeah, not the fact that they have some neighbor who's doing worse than they are.
Yeah, I've always said take the win. Now, Rose sent me an email because we are talking about, you know, the economy and Morgan Stanley. And she says, even though the stock market is not a true reflection of the economy, the market has been relatively stable under the Biden administration. Today, it closed at over 35,000. I just don't understand why rich investors and corporations are not praising and supporting Joe Biden. What do you think? That's a question for you. I'm never someone who points to Wall Street and says, oh, look how wonderful they're doing, therefore all of us are doing well. But I'm curious, given that question, what do you think?
Well, what I look at isn't the stock prices. What I look at is the fact that more people have jobs. Fewer people are looking for jobs. Fewer people are unemployed. Wages are up. Those are the kinds of things I look at. And then those things mean more people have money to spend and companies are doing better. You know, more people are buying burritos for Chipotle because they can spend $15 or $20 on having lunch with their kids. And that's why companies are doing better. When people have more money to spend, companies make more money because the people spend the money.
Yeah.
Money trickles up. That's what I've been trying to tell people for years. These trickle-down people are just wrong. Money trickles up all the time, and that's how I do well. People pay their iPhone bills every month. People make their rent every month. People pay their mortgages every month. And investors like me make money from all of those little payments added up. So I think they should be happy. But somehow, maybe they just want to take pleasure in, I don't know, other people not doing as well as they are.
Yeah, I don't know either. But like I said, I don't spend a lot of time looking at Wall Street and the numbers because I don't have a lot of, unlike you, I don't have a lot of investments that I have to worry about. And I think most working people don't either. But we are trained, Morris, to say that the country's doing well if Wall Street's doing well. And I don't know that that's the right barometer. In fact, I know it's not the right barometer.
It's not. It's not the right, I mean, it kind of correlates because when everyone does well, everyone else does well too. So people, it kind of moves together.
Yeah, I don't know about that so much. When Wall Street's doing really well and they're fat and happy, that doesn't seem to trickle down as much as you would hope it would.
Well, no, it doesn't trickle down. It trickles up. When everyone's doing well and making money and people have jobs and fewer people are unemployed, that's what makes the stock market go up. It's not trickle down, it's trickle up. So that's how they correlate. It's the cause is people having money to spend, and the net result is the stock market doing well too.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Morris Pearl. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires. PatrioticMillionaires.org is the website if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Now, we had a wonderful experience in Chicago. Got to sit down with one of your colleagues, one of the folks who's out there doing this great economy project that you guys are part of. Kat Hadley was on the program sharing some thoughts and talking about, you know, that really sexy topic of taxes. And, you know, I got into it a little bit yesterday where I said, look, if we had a much higher tax rate, I believe we would have much more investment from the private sector. We would have higher wages and probably even lower CEO pay because, you know, why give it to someone if the government's only going to take more of it? And I got a huge pushback from folks going, no, you're just a tax and spend liberal. So I wanted to bring this up to you, the idea of higher tax rates, because it's something you guys advocate for. There are positives that we've seen in the past that I think if we can do what the right has done masterfully and train people to, when they hear hear raising taxes, they don't foam at the mouth like Pavlovian dogs. They ask, on whom shall we raise taxes and for what shall we use it for? Maybe we got a shot at doing some good things in the future.
Look back at the video. Like, people made music videos during World War II about how patriotic it was to pay taxes and how everyone paid taxes. And they were promoting it. That was the first time that a lot of people paid income taxes, was during the Second World War. And it used to be patriotic to do your fair share, and people were proud of it. You know, until people like Ronald Reagan and then Donald Trump came along and told them, oh, only stupid people pay taxes. So that is part of what we're trying to change. We really are. You know, one of the things we're promoting is the Oligarch Act. We want to charge really rich people that have 1,000 times the wealth of the median family. So that means people that have like $120 million of wealth, a 2% tax on their wealth, which is probably less than what you pay as a percentage of the value of your home in your tax on your real estate. But we think that people should be taxed on all of their wealth, whether it's homeowners or businesses or stocks and bonds or whatever it is, if you're above 120 million or so. Thousand times median family.
But here's the thing, and you listen to the Ron Johnsons of the world who are going to say more, is that, you know, you rich people pay all the taxes and we shouldn't overburden you because you're overburdened enough.
Well, it's true that by some definition, rich people pay all the taxes because people who are impoverished don't pay much taxes. So in that sense, it's obvious, if, you know, the same way that bank robbers only rob banks because that's where money is. You know, you can't get taxes from people that don't have any money at all. So all the taxes have to come from people that have some money.
Yeah.
But no, it's not that we're overburdened in having to pay all the taxes, because the rich people have all of the money. So that makes sense. They should pay the taxes. And if we're asking people to pay 2% of their wealth, which is probably less than a typical homeowner in America pays, because most of their wealth is their house and they pay real estate taxes. So we're actually asking rich business owners and investors to do the same kind of thing that America's asked middle-class homeowners to do for generations.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you're advocating for anything like I would, which is, you know, we had a socialist president a number of years ago, Dwight Eisenhower, and he had a tax code that, you know, hey, seemed to work pretty well back then.
And things were pretty good in the Eisenhower days. And I think we have to go back to some of the things we did during the Eisenhower administration. I've actually asked our senators to change some of the rules back to the way they were during the Eisenhower administration. That's when they invented blue slips to prevent Eisenhower from appointing liberal judges who would order integrations of schools.
It's just quite, you know, we're in this weird moment that we're just, it's when you stop and you think about all of the ways that the wealth of this country is being used, and there's so much better ways that we could do things, investing more in infrastructure and in education, except in Florida. I'm curious your thoughts on education in Florida, because evidently what they're going to be teaching about slavery is that slavery was a good thing, taught those slaves some skills, got them some free education. It was a good thing. Thoughts on that?
That's very sad. It really is. I mean, it's just like, I think these guys, and what they really want is, they're saying our children had nothing to do with slavery, so we don't want them to feel guilty about it. That's their bottom line thing. Now, I don't tell people to feel guilty about anything. We don't tell our patriotic millionaire members to feel guilty about being rich. We think it's great to be rich. Everyone should do it.
Yeah.
I've tried it. It's good.
I'm trying.
So we don't think we should tell people to feel guilty about what happened in the past, but we think they should know what happened in the past. And I think they should know that what happened in the past affects what's happening in the present and the future, because the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of, you know, the slaves are not doing as well as the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the people that own the slaves. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it.
Yeah, no, look, Brian Kemp's family owned slaves. My family did not. I can say that with certainty, that because they were thrown off reservations and, you know, whole bunch of stuff. But then the question becomes, you know, how do we come together on these issues when we're being such torn apart? And, you know, something as simple as how our economy is viewed. I mean, I was looking at the polling numbers that Biden is, you know, is underwater on the economy when things are actually moving in the right direction.
I think part of it is that we have to. I'm hoping that people think about how well am I doing, not am I doing better than my neighbors. I think that's one thing that we're trying to get people to think about. And I think that we have to get people to think that way. And it's hard because we're saying that, oh, the rich people should pay more tax. And honestly, it's not going to make any difference in your life if we get Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg to pay more taxes. But it's going to make things more fair for everyone. And in the long run, I think it's better. And honestly, I think it's better for the businesses like Amazon and Facebook too, if we have less inequality in our society and more people that can buy all the stuff that they're advertising.
No, I'm right there with you. And look, at the end of the day, as I keep saying, if we have higher tax rates, that will equate to higher wages for workers. Because look, rich people aren't going to want to give their money to governments. They're going to want to invest in, as in the past, library systems like Carnegie did, hospitals. I see people's names slapped all over that. We've always left plenty of loopholes.
Rich people want to stay rich.
Yeah.
And they want to be richer than their neighbors. And they think they're in a competition. And that's how they got rich in the first place. They're very competitive people. And they're just driven to win the race or win the battle. You know, I've worked with people who make millions of dollars a year and are just still just that driven more than anyone else. And that's how they got rich in the first place.
Morris, as always, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. The Great Economy Project, I'm looking forward to more of that being rolled out, especially in my state of Pennsylvania. If people want to check out the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Tons of resource, tons of stuff there. You can even figure out how to crack the code to save America. I highly suggest it. Morris Pearl, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick. See you soon.
Good stuff. Again, I want to make sure you check out the website and the work that they do with the Great Economy Project and all of that. We're going to take a quick break, back with your thoughts. Stick around to listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. God bless y'all.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I saw this Facebook post that got me thinking. you can't make this stuff up. I mean, you really can't. You got this woman who is the executive vice president of, how did this go? She was like the executive vice president of you know, customer service. Oh, hold on, here it is. She was the executive vice president and chief customer experience officer. That's the one that caught me. It's not a customer service. It's customer experience. So she's the executive vice president, chief customer experience officer at Delta Airlines. Now, as you understand, you know, there have been a couple of unions trying to organize the workers at Delta who have been, you know, saying, look, we want better wages, hours, conditions. And if you remember, I think it was like 2 years ago, where we talked, maybe even three, where Delta ran this campaign and going, you know, instead of paying dues, you could take your kids to a baseball game. Or instead of paying dues, you could get this wonderful game, this gaming system. And they actually said this with a straight face. And, you know, we mocked them, you know, quite a bit. Because, hey, with a union card, you can get better wages, hours, conditions. With a union card, you can have a say on the job. With a union card, you can put up with not the kind of BS that you're putting up with now. Because I find it interesting that this woman who is now she's the executive vice president and chief customer experience officer, she's standing in front of a sports car, really, really sharp car. Nice car. And then that's in front of a plane. And she puts, when your ride is this good, who needs a plane? And you go, that's funny, haha. Except the fact of the matter is, on this very day, Reuters put out a story that the U.S. is investigating why Delta's passengers were sitting on a plane for hours in extreme heat. You know, why the head experience officer there, you know, the executive vice president and chief customer experience officer was out, you know, toying with her car that has Delta written on the side of it and not worrying about the passengers who were left on board an airplane with triple digit heat. You know, just a thought, why these passengers were on a plane in Las Vegas and sat there for 4 hours in triple digit heat. This, again, is why the workers are trying to organize. And this is why passengers should be going, yeah, can we get those flight attendants unionized? Can we get those people unionized so they can advocate on our behalf and get us off this hot plane? I'm still waiting to hear what comes of this. I think at some point this is where government has to step in, because you got to wonder what's it going to, you know, with temperatures going where they are, you know, heat exposure is coming. And to be sequestered on one of those big tubes for that long, I don't know. You'd think there'd be a rule. But hold on, wait a second. I'm remembering what someone emailed me about why deregulation was good for workers. I'm trying to remember. Maybe someone could help me with this one. Maybe the person who emailed me and said Republicans support working people by deregulating things. You know, like how long you can stay on a plane with triple digit, you know, heat. I got to wonder, how does that help? Maybe it helps sweat out, you know, some excess, you know, calories or something. Maybe it makes you lighter. I don't know. But it seems kind of stupid to me. But I wish the folks at Delta the best. I hope that the organizing campaign continues and they are victorious and they get a contract. But here's the thing, what I know. A company like Delta, who's hell-bent on ensuring that workers don't get their voice on the job, our laws are not on their side. And this is why, again, we need to have, some labor law reform. We do need to have some ability to fight for the kind of things that ensure that this doesn't happen. How disgraceful. I mean, the picture is just a disgrace to me. I mean, it really is. It's a nice car, though. It's a really nice car. How she's the executive vice president of and chief customer experience officer, I'm not quite sure. I got to wonder how many inflated price tickets went into making sure she got the card with the Delta name on it. And did we as taxpayers, you know, pay for that really super sporty car. Because, like she said, you know, hey, when your ride's this good, who needs a plane? I wonder if she'll be fired for that. Seems kind of counterintuitive to what she's trying to pull off. Unless she was going to shuttle people back and forth from the triple-digit plane back to the terminal in her car and let them sit there with the air conditioning on. I don't see how that's helpful. But I do want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1971. It was an historic day for the men and women who deliver the U.S. mail. It was the day that the American Postal Workers Union and the National Association of Letter Carriers signed their first ever union contract. Although there had been earlier postal unions, they did not have formal bargaining rights. Postal wages were set by Congress. This meant that the starting wage for postal workers was only $6,200 in 1970. Many of these workers actually qualified for food stamps. Frustrated at their low pay and working conditions, postal workers in New York City walked off the job. Soon, 200,000 of their fellow workers across 30 major cities joined them on the picket lines. A story in Time magazine described the impact of the work action, writing, quote, "The first national postal stoppage in U.S. history and the largest walkout ever against the federal government, the postal strike almost immediately began to strangle the operation of commerce, impair government functions, and vastly inconvenience the public." To end the strike, Congress awarded the workers a 6% raise. But even more importantly, Congress decided to reorganize the Postal Service. The Post Office Department changed its name to the United States Postal Service. With this reorganization, postal workers won for the first time the right to bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Their first contract raised the starting wage to $8,488 a year, a more than 30% increase to the pay level before the strike. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
All those firecrackers on July 4th got me thinking about the headline revolutionaries who signed the 1776 Declaration, fought the Brits for independence, hammered out the Constitution, and installed our Bill of Rights. Old Ben, Monticello Tom, General George, Alex, pamphleteer Tommy Paine, Jimmy and Dolly, Tea Party Sam, and others got America's democratic experiment started. And they're rightly saluted today from schoolrooms to political gatherings of both major parties as true patriots. Reflecting on that generation's remarkable impact reveals the historic potential of our people's democratic spirit. But it also raises the unavoidable contrast with our present crop of leading political characters. This is worth noting now because the 4th has become the opening bell for America's quadrennial presidential run. Yes, ready or not, the first debates are only a month away and Iowa's Republican caucuses are set for January 15. So here's my question. Given the current state of our two major parties, would any of the patriots of 76 have a snowball's chance in hell of being nominated for president of the country they founded? Consider George Washington. The GOP's MAGA crowd would boo him off the stage. Trump would mock the general as Toothless George, and the party of QAnon, anti-woke nonsense, and Marjorie Taylor Greene would place him behind uber-rich ego-trippers like Vivek Ramaswamy and Doug Burgum. Democrats, while today's grassroots Dems would rally enthusiastically to the little d democratic principles and firebrand activism of Thomas Paine or Samuel Adams, the party's pusillanimous corporate-hugging establishment would bury both in a muddy deluge of money and lies. This is Jim Hightower saying, this political reality shouldn't depress us, but provoke us into demanding and doing better. Maybe greatness is now beyond us, but shouldn't we strive for more than mediocrity and outright goofiness?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we were in Chicago for Netroots Nation, and one of the things that we talked about while we were in Chicago was the writer's strike and the SAG-AFTRA strike that's going on. Basically all of Hollywood on strike right now because the studios are stupid. But I remember talking with Patty Vasquez and saying, look, you know, the reality is I don't know why the issue that's being isn't being thrown out to everyone is, hey, this is the first battle in the AI war. This is the first battle in the future. And maybe since Congress isn't going to do anything, we can't get anything done in the halls of power. Maybe this is where we control some of what the future is. Maybe we don't have to be Luddites and smash the machine. Maybe we can control it. And it's workers who are doing this. And I got to tell you, I was surprised today. Got an email from the good folks over at Mother Jones saying, hey, we got this guy. He wrote something. And it's exactly what we were talking about doing. That's why I've asked Rafael Agustin to come talk with us. He's the CEO of the Latino Film Institute. He's also on the board of Mother Jones. He's written a great piece on why he's on strike. He says, I'm a striking TV writer, and here's why we're doing it. Rafael, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, this in a very fortuitous way came into my lap and is exactly what we were just talking about the other day, that this is the front lines of that AI war. This is the front line of claiming our individual, our personality, our voice, our image, all of this stuff. And why aren't we screaming this from the mountaintop? So good on you for writing this piece. So why aren't we doing more of that?
We're not doing more because, quite frankly, as a nation, we've done a good job at destroying the union and labor movement of this country, right? In the mid-1950s, there was about 34% of all workers were part of a union. Today, it's less than 10%. And everything that you're discussing is exactly right. Tech companies, with their idea of disruption, keep entering industries and turning all workers into the gig economy. Like the idea of Airbnb, of Spotify, of Uber, it came at a great cost for the labor of like the hotel industry, the music industry, the taxi driving industry. But tech companies faced something in Hollywood that they never expected. And that is a very strong union town. That's why we're standing up. That's why we're fighting back. And it's easy to think, oh, a bunch of rich writers and a bunch of rich actors are just like whining and complaining, but it's not.
No.
That's why I wanted to write this piece, because I wanted to frame it in the way that it should be framed. And that's that this is truly the labor fight of our generation. It boils down to tech versus humanity. Right.
No, and the reality is you're right. And because, you know, people think Hollywood, they think, you know, they think the big stars. And the reality is the vast majority of people who work in film or TV or writers, these are people who are just barely getting by and maybe having to work second, third, fourth jobs to follow their passion. So when I heard that extras would be going to a set and having their image basically cloned in perpetuity, I'm going, well, that can't happen. You have to strike when that's being thrown on the table. But I haven't heard anyone else tell me that than what Patty shared with me.
The sad thing is that extras who are non-union have already signed away their likeness without even knowing it, because they didn't know what they were signing. And these AI companies have taken their likeness in perpetuity. But that's why you need a strong union behind you to fight whatever's happening clandestinely.
Now, how, you know, I've had a couple of people ask me how long I think this is going to last. And my answer is always hopefully one day longer than the executives want it to go, because I want the workers to win in this. Ultimately, you've got to be there as long as you have to be, because this is really your existence, isn't it? I mean, if you're not being paid for the work that you're doing, if your likeness is being stolen, if your creativity is being stolen, you know what, you know, because I look at this streaming stuff, you're not being paid for. Why would anybody want this job? And to me, if you can't make a living at this, maybe it's time to shut it down where we are right now.
And essentially that's why the leadership of our guild decided to fight back, because the rich folks, they're not affected by this. The showrunners, the writer producers, they're fine. What they're truly fighting for is the preservation of writing as a career. It's going to be decimated. We are not doing any mentorship. We're not properly compensating the next generation of writers. And this AI fight, this fight with artificial intelligence, is very scary. In fact, when our field leadership went in to talk to the studios, they didn't even think it was a problem. They're like, okay, we can all agree that scripts are written by human beings, right? And the negotiators on the other side were like, well, we don't want to take away the right for the studios to use AI to generate scripts. And we were like, oh, hell no. Now we're striking because we know what you're doing. Last time they said, oh, we don't want to talk about internet right now because who knows what it'll do. And then streaming became a thing. So they're already thinking into the future. And in their future, right, the number one rule of economics, how do you make a profit? You exploit labor. And in their future, not only do they exploit labor, they evaporate and decimate labor. Because in their perfect world, a season of television is no longer written by 10 to 14 writers. It is written by one writer and one AI machine. That's what the future that they want. And that's the future that we have to put an end to.
And they get to keep all the profits. And this is one of those moments where, you know, I've been talking about this study that was done about 5 years ago that said, you know, in 20 years, half of the jobs that we do currently will all be replaced by robotics and AI. This is the front line of that. Now, look, there are other jobs that have been replaced already, but this is a mass scale. This is an industry that's been taking hits for years. But this is the end of you guys. There's I see nothing left on the other side, especially when you're talking about the streaming stuff. Because again, how writers, as I understand, and you help me if I'm wrong here, but as they're paid by you know, repeats, by being things being put re-aired and paid for,
yeah,
in residuals that come over the years.
You're talking about residual checks, which, by the way, the Writers Guild of America fought for and won back in 1953. These are fights we already had 70 years ago. The thing that changed is that tech companies have come into town and try to rewrite the laws, the rules, the history of it all. Because let me just, so your audience could understand, residual checks and broadcasting and like the networks that we see for free on TV, right? Because they're supported by advertising and broadcasting. When my episode of television reruns, I get a check for that. And these residual checks, not only did we earn, they keep us afloat in between jobs or when we're trying to develop a new show. It's how we provide for our families. So a perfect example is a writer shared recently. He used to write a procedural show for broadcast, and his residual checks were close to $22,000 every time one of his episodes re-aired, $22,000. He went to write for a streamer, right? The Netflix, the Amazons, the Apple, Hulu of the world. His residual checks now for that same show is now $120.
Wow.
From $22,000 to $120. That is what is happening in Hollywood, and that's what the tech companies are trying to get away with.
So ultimately, what you're talking about is a massive redistribution of wealth
away
from working people to these executives and the shareholders.
Correct.
And that's what this fight is about, you know, because I've had people email me and say, well, you know, you greedy union members always going on strike, because there is a, you know, it's hot, you know, strike summer. It's hot labor summer. And we are seeing people who have had enough coming out of the pandemic, you know, taking on that title of hero and essential and all that, and now demanding to be treated as such. But you're just trying to fight for your existence.
But Rick, you're bringing up the most perfect point in the world. The studios can 100% afford to give us what we're asking for. What they cannot afford is to show the world that strikes work. That is what they're really afraid of.
No, and that's all companies. You know, I'm looking at what's going on at UPS and the potential of a strike there, and I hope that doesn't get ugly. But you're spot on. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Raphael Augustine. He's the CEO of the Latino Film Institute, also a board member at Mother Jones. He's got a piece at Mother Jones I hope you'll take a look at. I'm a striking TV writer, and here's why we're doing this. Now, again, you know, are we Luddites? Are we saying that we, you know, technology should be destroyed? Because I had some people asking, saying, hey, you know, is it that we don't want to use technology? You know, what's the gist? You're not against technology. You're just saying, I'd prefer it not replace me, and I would prefer it not put my face on.
Correct. And in the case of the writers, it was very simple. We wanted to come to terms that all scripts are generated by human beings. And writers can use AI as research or as support, but what you can't do is generate scripts directly from AI. For many reasons outside of preserving the profession of writing, we have to get legislation in here. We have to get copyright violation clause in here. I mean, if an AI, if you tell an AI machine, give me a Quentin Tarantino script, it will spit out a Quentin Tarantino script. But how does it know what a Quentin Tarantino script is? It was fed so many already. So when we're talking about AI in Hollywood, we're really talking about plagiarism machines.
No, and that's where I think Sarah Silverman is now engaged in a lawsuit on this very thing, that nothing AI does is original, and it's all copywritten, and it's basically just theft. Is that the way forward? Because I know you said there needs to be some legislation, and I wish we were a functional country that could do some of that. But I just don't see that we're I don't see we're capable of doing something that is that big, given our political climate. Or do you disagree?
I have hope. I truly have hope, and more importantly, I'm hoping that Hollywood and California can lead on this. There are a few legislators, state and federal, who are currently meeting on this, and we hope to set the standard of how to push back and how to fight for this. Unfortunately, everyone is so confused by it. They don't even know what to do. I mean, look at our legislators in Washington. They can barely get through a hearing on Facebook, for crying out loud.
Yeah. But I got to tell you, I loved the one of the passages you wrote about, you know, not being the typical union striker. And you wrote, we're not rugged, we're neurotic. Our carpal tunnel doesn't come from lifting heavy things, but from typing too much. But like every other union member in this country, we are over-caffeinated and we know our worth, and we refuse to be exploited. And that to me is really an important line that I think every working person in this country, regardless if you're currently in a union or not, should be taking to heart. The fact that your labor is worth something, the hours of your life are worth something, and you should be demanding better.
And the reason why I wanted to point that out is because being on the picket lines, what I've seen most is the support that we get from other union members. It never comes from like the expensive Teslas that drive by. It comes from the big rigs. It comes from the bus drivers. It comes from the electrical vehicles. It comes from the county utility vehicles. It comes from other union members in Los Angeles. And that's the beauty.
No, and this is where I've been saying, Raphael, for a very long time. And I every time there's a strike, anyone who's listening in a strike area, go adopt a striker, spend the day and walk with them, bring them a coffee, a soda, a dozen donuts, a pizza, something, but spend time with that striker, hear their stories, and get more bodies on the line. Because as I've always said, the bigger the strike, the bigger the picket line, the shorter the strike. So we need people to get out there. But this is one of those moments where, you know, I keep saying that the working class can unite. The way we reunite this country is to reunionize and get people out on those picket lines fighting for something. Because look, I knew some old Teamsters back, you know, they fought the battles of the 50s and 60s. And the old timers would tell the stories of, you know, how they went out on strike every couple of years just to get people to feel the sense that they fought and won something. Because if you fought for something and you won something, you're never going to give it up. So I see this as a bunch of writers and a bunch of people who, you know, you're right, they're not lifting boxes. Them standing strong 12 weeks into this, them fighting for better, we can all do it.
Well, we could all do it. But you also bring up an important point that the middle class of this country and the better working conditions that we have all were built on the backs of strong unions and strong union fights and strikes. I pointed out at the top that we went from having 34% of our labor belonging to a union in the 50s to only 10%. That's what's so heartbreaking. I agree with you. We have to unionize more. The working class, the labor force only makes a stronger America, a stronger economy, and a stronger nation.
So lastly, last question I've got for you, because I want to make sure people understand the gist of what's going on. We talked about the AI. We talked about, you know, keeping your face and your copyright and your intellect. Also about the residuals and the pay structure. Is there something? Is there more to this that we need to know? Is there more that we need to get behind?
Data. Unfortunately, these tech companies hide behind data, and the problem is, are we overpaid for shows that are not being seen on streamers, or are we underpaid for big hits? Spoiler alert, it's the latter, right?
Yeah.
So we're trying to get compensated for the success of his work, for our work as well. If it's a flop, we understand why we won't get paid that much. But if it's a gigantic hit, like Squid Game, you saw the hundreds of millions of dollars they made, and that creator made nothing from that. At least not from season one. He's probably fighting for a much bigger season two contract. But that's the point. Like, we need to see data. We need to be honest about the data. Broadcast television for decades always show their data. The streamers and tech companies go, oh, we don't share our data. But guess what? Netflix is now going to provide an ad-supported service, which means that Netflix realized, oh, we need advertising to make money. Oh, we might look at this old model of doing television, but then you can't tell the labor force, oh, we can't show you our data.
Yeah.
But you are going to show your data to advertisers? I'm sorry, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, this is a reason to walk out of Netflix. This is a reason to strike and to carry on. But Rafael, I appreciate the time. I want you to come back and keep us up to date on what's going on as this continues. I'm hoping it's short, but I fear this is going to be a long one.
One day longer, one day stronger, my brother.
There you go. I appreciate the time, Rafael Agustin. He's the CEO of the Latino Film Institute, also a board member over at Mother Jones. Make sure you check out his article. I am a striking TV writer, and here's why we're doing this. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a quick look at it. Can take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Good time. Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day New York City newsboys went on strike. A newspaper article noted, "The Newsboys Union has decided to tie up the World and the Journal. They have struck for better rates on the evening editions of these papers, and their demands have been refused. Therefore, beginning with the first appearance of the redheaded extras this noon, the boys are going to refuse to sell. Envoys have been going up and down the line passing the word. Ye don't sell no more World or Journal, or ye get your face punched in, see?" The main issue of the strike was that the papers had sold for more money during the Spanish-American War, as people were clamoring for news of the conflict. But as the war ended, the boom dried up. The newsboys had paid more for the papers, but could not make the money back from their readers. The article quoted one of the striking newsboys saying, "They put the prices to 6 papes for a dime when the war began. Den, when the war quit, and there wasn't no such sale for the papes, and we wanted to get them 2 for a cent again, but they wouldn't. That's what we're going on strike for now. The cops is all busy, and we can do any scab newsboys that show his face without police interference. We're here for our rights, and we will die defending them. At the rates they give us now, we can't make on ye 4 cents on 10 papes.
the Pulitzer-owned World and the Hearst-owned Journal did not reduce prices after the war. But, in the end, the newspaper's management did agree to buy back any unsold copies. And thus, the strike ended on August 2nd, marking a small step forward. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So I got to finish up with this, the Texas governor. Greg Abbott doing some pretty sleazy, pretty ugly, pretty horrible stuff. Maybe you've seen the stories of what they're doing down on the Rio Grande, but evidently Abbott and his goons, I got to tell you, you know, it's almost like Nazi stuff. It's the cruelty is the point kind of stuff. The New York Times had a long story on the tactics that Texas is using on migrants, trying to come into the country. Now, look, I don't know the answer to our immigration problems. I don't have all the answers. I have some ideas, some things that we could be doing, should be doing. But the one thing that I do know that we don't deal with it by drowning children. I'm pretty sure that's not the pro-life position, or is it? Now remember, you got Abbott, pro-life guy, putting nets in the water so that people get tangled up, doing all kinds of things to cause injuries, and the one story where evidently there's like a barbed wire fence that goes across, people threw some stuff over it to try and get over it, the border patrol people or I think the Texas soldier, whoever they were, are ripping this stuff away so people are getting injured, and go back to Texas or go back to Mexico, and you go again, don't know the answer entirely. Congress should probably do its job. But this kind of cruelty, and I know, here's the thing, I know, the cruelty is the point. The more cruel that you can be to people, the I guess as the mindset goes, the Stephen Millers of the world would have you, if there's a boat coming over, sink it. Because if you remember during the Trump years, they actually wanted to use drones to sink boats coming from other places. If you got migrants coming here, sink the boat, make them swim. Maybe they can fight with the sharks. I don't know that that's the right answer. I have said that, and I go back to 2010 and 11 with the Tea Party, who were all tingly in the panties over foreign aid. I was saying that the way that you keep people in their countries, a lot of foreign aid, make it more desirable to stay home, because I can't imagine people want to walk 1,000 miles. I can't imagine people want to swim across the sludge river. I can't imagine that they want to get the possibility of being killed or mutilated or maimed. I can't imagine they want that. But the prospect of there being something better at the end of the horrible journey, because it's so desperate at home, maybe something we should possibly think about. Now, I have my conservative friends who say, well, it's not our job to be, the person who makes all the rest of the world better. Yeah, kind of is. We've kind of put ourselves in that position. We've kind of done that. And if you're not solving some of the problems with your neighbors, if you're not a good neighbor, you're going to have problems. And this is one of those things where, man, the cruelty being the point, I got to think in 20, 30, 50, 100 years, there's going to be people who are around reading the stories of what Abbott and what conservatives are doing. The kind of cruelty, the kind of mean-spiritedness that is coming from the right because they can. I got to wonder what future generations are going to think. And what they're going to think of those of us who stayed silent. This is disgraceful. Look, I don't know all the answers to our immigration troubles, but I'm pretty sure this is the wrong way.
I'm pretty sure children drowning, not in the best interest of our policy. I want to hear your thoughts, though. What do you think? Should we be drowning kids? Should we be shooting down boats? Should we sinking ships as people are trying to sail here? Because after all, you know, you got to wonder where your ancestors came from. Did they come on a boat that we could have shot down? I know. I'm here now. Pull up the ladder. Step on the fingers of the person behind you. Yeah. Anyway, I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at the Rick Smith Show.com. If you miss any...